The founders forgot that we had medical liberty.
We seem to be losing by taking the side of the middle. And we seem to constantly be losing.
I think Trump has made some kind of arrangements with Russia.
This person has made the allegations that they were a man.
If there's content that's borderline, that's content that we basically will not.
There is no second best. There is no second best crypto asset.
Let's talk about science.
I respect you and I have a great deal of appreciation to you, JF, because in a time when everybody was attacking me, when Sargon doxed me and smeared me, you were the only one who gave me a platform, and you were very kind in helping me put the truth out there.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG Tonight. How are you doing, people of the regular chat? Okay, my window was playing. Today is an important day, and if you don't like math, it's okay, you can leave. I wouldn't leave. I mean, why would you leave? Even if you don't understand all of the math, you should stay around. This is important, what's happening. I believe that what I'm finding is so much more important than people treat it as. Because we're discovering Grok 4 has massive mathematical abilities, genius levels of mathematics thinking, to the point where... this morning I challenged AI. I published my paper... Letter to AI on the Goldbeck Conjecture. This is 10 years worth of work that I've been doing, and I've been sitting on this for a couple of years. I mean, the final product is pretty much something I had discovered about 5 years ago. And I had kind of released little bells. There were people paying me super chats. And I was like, okay, here's the principle. But I had never really released a paper in writing with the full demonstration. So I did it because, well, first, I'm 41 years old, and I have looked at... So I'm stuck with 9 problems. I will never be able to prove the Goldbeck conjecture before I die. It's hard to admit, but I brought it to a point where I'd like to share that point. But I was like, how do I share this with AI? Do I keep it a secret conversation? And then recently, Elon Musk came publicly and started talking about how he would like AI to make a discovery. And I was like, those are two elements of my life that I can combine here. I've been sitting on this genius, great math of the Goldbeck conjecture for at least 5 years. I've always hesitated at publishing it because it's not a complete proof. So people say, he's publishing crap. He's publishing incomplete stuff. I didn't want to annoy people. But then the invitation of Elon Musk was too tempting because I was like, what if I can cause within a week, within a month, within 10 years? What if I can cause within my lifetime the proof of the Goldbeck conjecture, even if it's not from me? Even if it comes from someone else, even if it's a Chinaman just going through my equation and helping himself with it, or if it's Grok. And so I thought this is the perfect circumstance by which I can share my incomplete work on the Goldbeck conjecture. This stems from many years of work. I started doing some loops at first. I wanted to prove the Goldbeck conjecture quick, you know, with a little trick. And I was doing clever loops, but they weren't fully working. And I never really achieved what I wanted with them. But eventually, I come to a quantitative approach of the Goldbeck conjecture. And I'm like, okay, this is something I've never seen in the literature. A full equation. I come up with a full equation to that literally represents the Goldbeck count, the count of pairs of primes that sum to an even number. Now, there are people who have done estimates and all, and I'm always annoyed when I read math literature. I'm not super knowledgeable in math literature because I'm annoyed at their approximations and how did you get there? How did you get to an approximation like this? And to what extent is an approximation variable at all? I want exact math. And I have been, so about 7 years ago, maybe, I've been abandoning the loop-based approach, and I've been determined to how do I find a single equation that is in the Euclidean sense, in the deterministic sense of math, is the Goldbach count. Because one thing about the Goldbach count is it's a qualitative ID. It's a qualitative ID, the Goldbach count. Okay, you count the pairs, but it's also a number. And therefore, it has to fall within the reach of number theory as a, as an actual construct that can be symbolized by meaningful math. Now, this was done with the goal, of course, of proving the Goldbach conjecture. The Goldbach conjecture is that there is always at least one pair. So there is no even number for which there is not a pair of primes that sum to it. So one example of a pair of Goldbach prime. Let's say you start with an even number, 14. Well, 14 has a pair, as a Goldbach pair in 11 plus 3. 11 is a prime, 3 is a prime, gives you 14. 14 is an even number, it has a Goldbach pair. Let's try 16. 16 equals 13 plus 3. That's a Goldbach pair. And it seems that there is not a single number, a single even number for which there is no Goldbach pair. And so that's where we start. That's how it starts. And I just want to show you. So my letter has framed the Goldbach conjecture as 9 different problems that I frame for AI. And I tell AI, look, solve these 9 problems and you will have made a discovery, just like Elon Musk wants you to have. So I fragmented the Goldbach conjecture into 9 little mathematical riddles, if you will, that each have their fascinating aspect to them. We'll get into this, but each of them has their bizarre little tweak to them that make it kind of weird. Just want to show you how tight Grok 4 is in thinking. And I called it out thinking that he had made an error, and he didn't. He was like, no, Jeff, I'm correct. This is one of my 9 mathematical challenges, which is find a line, prove a red line below this empirical data set that hold for all numbers up to infinity, and below which the blue circles will never come, basically. And look at what Grok 4 found. He found a super optimized constant, computing it from the Mertens-Meissel constant and the Euler-Mascheroni constant, and found the lower bound for gamma 1, my first mathematical problem out of 9. And look at how tight it is. I mean, Grok found such a tight limit, and you know that up to infinity, it doesn't matter if we were to keep going on the right, the product of what I call gamma 1 will stay above the red line. And the red line is defined as C times E divided by log of E to the square. And this all stems from straight thinking around Mertens-Meissel, around, you know, things that were demonstrated in the last 100 years. The fact that Grok 4 could take these things and translate them into my case and my special framing of the problem is absolutely astonishing to me. And we're discovering levels of intelligence that I did not expect yet. I knew we would get there at some point in AI, but I didn't know we would get there that quick. So I will just give you guys a feel of what I show in my paper so that you understand how I got there and how these mathematics may be a little scary if you don't know the symbols and all, but ultimately it boils down to very, very simple measure problems. And so hopefully I don't bore you guys. I know that whenever I will speak of AI and math, I know I will lose maybe half the audience I regularly have. I'm sorry, politics sucks these days. I am uninspired by politics, and I find it much more interesting to talk about this for now. I'll go back to politics, but when there's something interesting about it. Because the problem right now with politics is it's all rooting for your side. It's all, oh yeah, let's be loyal to Trump. And you see it on X. It's all, well, I've decided to be loyal to Trump. I won't complain about Epstein. And then some other people are, no, we're going to keep complaining about Epstein. And it's like, okay, but not very intelligent. I feel that civilization is kind of headed toward fucking stupidity, like monkey level of stupidity. I don't feel comfortable getting into that arena right now. I could talk about politics if some interesting event happens, but it's all bullshitting. It's all Rockin' Robin Hood says politics always sucks, no proof needed. Rodita Sid says just call it racist math, it will get viewers interested. Okay. So imagine that the composites are the Jews. We're trying to count the Jews. We don't want to do anything with these counts, okay? We just want to count. This is one of our pet peeve interests. We just like to count Jews. So let us count composites here. All right, so I got my little pad here. Let's try to see if I can do some illustrations. So when you have an even number, so we start with zero, and we're gonna go half the way of our even number. Let's say you have six. Let's say you have 12. And let's say you have 18. And then you have 24. And then you reach half of your even number, e divided by 2. Let's say that our even number is 50. Okay, so you got 25 here as e divided by 2. And then, so that's what I call the right. That's what I call PR in my paper, the right. And then if you go, continue progressing through the number line, and you will arrive to E. E equals 50. And here you're going to get 26. Here you're going to get 32. 38 and 44. This you can represent, you can split an even number in two in that form. And it's a very practical form to think about when you think about the Goldbeck conjecture, because then you have left and right. And you know that 6, 12, 18, 24 will never be primes. They cannot be primes. They are multiple of 6. But you know that the primes always appear either minus 1 or plus 1. So you know that the primes, they are in this region around your multiple of 6. 5, 7 is prime. 11, 13 is prime. 17, 19 is prime. 23, 25 is not prime, 27, not prime, 31, 33, 37, 39, 43, and 45, not prime. So you know that a prime will always be, if you forget about 2 and forget about 3, we're not considering them primes for our perspective on the Goldbeck conjecture. Now, the classical Goldbeck conjecture would allow for 3 to be part of a sum, but I don't. I don't because I let the math guide me. And the math showed me that 3 is a completely separate phenomenon unrelated to my quantifications of the Goldbeck conjecture. Same thing with e divided by 2, classically interpreted as a potential Goldbeck pair. But in my case, I reject it. So I'm only quantifying the multiples of 6 plus minus 1. I'm looking for the primes in there. So my first... Basically, when I started asking questions around this, I was like, okay. So the first thing I note is that there's always a side on the other side that will be a multiple of 3, and therefore that will make a complete side canceled. So 45 is a multiple of 3. 39 is a multiple of 3. 33 is a multiple of 3. 27 is a multiple of 3. So this is why in the paper, I said it's very important to determine whether you have a type 1, 2, or 3 even number, because you already lose half of your potential Goldbeck pair, because one side, unless you have an even number that's a multiple of 3 itself, one side will always be barred by the multiple of 3. These multiple of 3 are composites, therefore they cannot be Goldbeck pairs. So you have to chop out already half of the space of availabilities. So you're only working with the primes of the other side here as being the potential basis for a Goldbeck pair. But then you're stuck with a problem, which is that take, for example, 5. 5 does not, is in an invalid state to contribute to a Goldbeck pair. However, look at its next multiple. 5 becomes 25 when it is squared, 5 times 5. And it is occupying potentially what could have been a Goldbeck pair on the right of this number. So that is how numbers, ultimately, they start as prime. They give you an opportunity to form a Goldbeck pair here. For example, here you have a Goldbeck pair, 7 and 43. they show up as prime. They give you an opportunity to form a Goldbeck pair. And then after, they mess up the opportunity of other Goldbeck pairs to exist, because they become composites. And there are two phenomenons here. 5 is stuck in the 6G minus 1 space. So it, on its first appearance, it's not really blocking something that you would have considered a Goldbeck pair. But it, on its next appearance, 6G minus 1 times 6G minus 1. Equals 6k plus 1. On the it inverts itself every time that it multiplies itself, so that if you have an even number of 5s that are powered, they're going to be on the plus 1 side. If you have an odd number of them that are powered, they're going to be on the left side. They're going to be on the 6g minus 1 side. So that's one of the things that's important to consider, which is considered in the equation. And then the question is, the problem is there are other multiples of 5 that are not illustrated here. For example, 10. 10 was not illustrated here, but it's a multiple of 5. 15 is 3 times 5. So basically, 5 makes jumps of 5. So the way a prime advances on the number line is it makes 5 steps, next composite arrives. It makes 5 more steps, next composite arrives. It makes 5 more steps, next composite arrives. And the rate of occupation at which they end up really stepping over the relevant gold-backed pairs is not 1, because you see 10 didn't align with a gold-backed pair, not 2 jumps, 15 didn't align with the gold-backed pair, not 20 doesn't align with the gold-backed pair. It's actually 6 times 5. You need to jump 6 times before the next potential gold-backed pair you will encounter. And in fact, that gold-backed pair is 35. 6 times 5, 35. So the rate at which a prime occupies the gold-backed pair is not the prime itself. It's 6 times the prime itself. And that's because the other ones are things that you wouldn't have considered as gold-backed pairs. Anyways. So that gives us the equation that I have here. And if you want to start from first principles and understand how it leads to the greater equation, this is it. So we remove 1 from the space because we don't want the number 1 to be a gold-backed pair. And then we basically divide the space that the number is by 6p, because we know that on every jump of 6 times the prime, we will be occupying a new gold-backed pair. The lambda here illustrates the problem of starting the count. So let's reset this. You have the problem that you have, let's say, number 5. You know it's going to occupy the 6g-1 space on its first occurrence. But then that's a prime. Then you know 6 times 5 later, it's going to be occupying the next 6g-1 spot. And then that will be 35. That will be a composite. And then the next time is going to be 65. So plus 6p. And that time is going to be a composite. And so on and so on and so on. And then when you come back on the left, it's going to keep making these 6p jumps. And it's going to be composite, 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 composite. Then you're going to arrive at E. And here, that distance, as well as that distance, the distance between 0 and 5, and the distance between E and its last composite, will not be 6p. You got 6p here, you got 6p here, you got 6p here, but an even number comes absolutely randomly in the bunch and just messes up the continued jumps. And this messing up, this offset, is what is measured by lambda. So lambda comes in and allows you to discount the offset and say, okay, 5 starts here. It starts kind of in between a 6p jump, but it starts here. So that is simply the principle behind equation 12. And if you just rearrange the term, you get to something more like equation 13. E minus 2 plus 12p, because you're going to divide by 12p, and everything has been multiplied by 2 simply here. Now, when you want to do... when you want to start counting, imagine I'm counting with 2 primes now. So here we were counting the number of composites formed by 5. Now, let's try counting the number of composites formed by 7. Well, 7 will make larger jumps, because it will make 6 times 7 jumps before it can occupy a gold back pairs. And you could quantify 7 on its own. Like this. 7 times 6 jumps every time. But you're going to find a problem, which is that sometimes the 6 times 7 jumps will align with the 6 times 5 jumps. The first occurrence of this is 35, where you have 7 times 5. And it's like, so if you were counting the composites, you would say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Those are the composites of 5. Now, suppose you were counting the composites of 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Let's say you have 6 composites formed by 7. And let's say you have a certain number, a higher number, 7 composites formed by 5, by P1, and 6 composites formed by P2. But here's the problem. Some of these composites are both from P2 and P1. Some of these composites are unfortunately the multiple of both. And so you cannot do 7 composites plus 6 composites equals 13 composites. The reality is you have to do minus 1 to account for this, to account for the meeting of composites onto a single composite that you double count. So that's what I call in the article double counts. Now, if you start correcting for the double counts, you start having the same problem when you come with 3 primes. So now with 3 primes, you have the problem that you've corrected too much. So you end up making an alternative row of plus 12p minus 12p1, p2. Plus 12p1, p2, p3. You correct and overcorrect and de-overcorrect and recorrect and overcorrect and over-recorrect. You end up in a cycle of, and you're getting closer and closer. And if you do it for as many primes as you're looking at, let's say you've done, let's say, 11. So 11 will make very large jumps. So let's say you have one composite of 11 here, one composite of 11 here. Now, if you do the sequence of corrections that I described in the article, you're going to end up with a rate of occupation that is real. You're going to end up with the right count. And this brings us... Now, there's two other problems that I mentioned in the article. So you're very close to a real count here. But you have another problem, which is that sometimes a composite on the right is also, let's say you have a composite here formed by the five oscillation with jumps of 5 times 6 between each wave here. The problem is on the other side of the gold back pair, you might have something like boom. You might have, say, 11 come in at steps of 11 times 6 and be a composite here too. And this is what I call a left-right composite. It needs to be accounted for. Because if you start doing the counts and corrections I've described, you're still stuck with the fact that here you have 2 composites, but that are blocking. Only one gold back pair. So you need to subtract those. And I've shown the method in my paper to how to subtract those. And then we are also stuck with another problem, which is the last problem before you get to my final equation. You have multiples of E. So as it turns out, it's not only those primes that are co-prime to E that can occupy a goldback potential spot. It's also those factors of E. So suppose that that your even number is something like 2 times 2 times 7. You're going to find that all of the cases of 7, all of the appearances of 7 in your even number will be mirrored by a multiple of 7 on the left. So when you have a 7 on the right, you have a 7 on the left. So this requires different treatment because these numbers that are part of the prime factorization of E, they occupy the goldback space, but at a reduced rate because they double up always. So doesn't matter if you encounter another 7, say at 35. If your E is a multiple of 7, you're going to get on the left some multiple of 7 also here. And so this is kind of a rate of consumption of the goldback pair divided by 2. simply it's less efficient at messing up the gold back because it's aligned with E and therefore it's consuming less of the gold back pairs for itself. Now in terms of the math emerging from all this, you end up having a PRPL math that is absolutely stunning to me. because when you start developing my equation in the what I call the epsilon vector, you end up that you have your first measure, which is PRPL, both equals 1. Okay? So that is, I'm going to look for a multiple of 1 on the right and a multiple of 1 on the left. In other words, I will look for nothing because I will look for number 1. That's how it starts. And therefore, I will measure the whole distance between E minus 2, that is the whole size of E, divided by 12 because I've shown that it's jumps of 6 and it's a two-sided vector. And this will give me my number of goldback pair, roughly. I say roughly because eventually there's a lambda term and all, but I included this in the article. But let's just look at it simply for now. Then I'm going to start looking at the composites of 5 on the right. And I'm going to look at nothing on the left. That is number 1. All composites of 5 on the right. Not looking for anything on the left. And then the space that will be occupied, the thing that will be consumed, I will put a minus. So here I have a plus. This is the number of goldback pairs I should have. But I will consume certain goldback pairs from the from the presence of the 5 multiples on the left. But then it gets messier. I will look at, let's say I have another prime, PR7. I will continue looking at nothing on the left, and I will get another correction term, E minus 2 divided by 12 times 7 will give me the rough occupation rate of 7 of the space of goldback. But then I need to do my overcorrection in this dimension here. So because there are numbers like 35 where both 5 and 7 will give me a minus. I need to correct this error, and I will do so by doing e minus 2 divided by 12 times 5 times 7. So you end up with pyramids of numbers, literally just pyramids of numbers where, okay, I needed to count these products, these composites, but it opens up a forced correction of that sort. And in fact, the reverse will be true. I will also be looking on the left for the composites of 5 while looking at nothing on the right. PR nothing. And I will be looking at PR 1, PL 7. So now I have another triangle that opens up, which will be E minus 2 divided by 12 times 7 times 5. That will be my correction term. And then I will have my two quantification terms. And E minus 2 divided by 12 times 7. So notice the exponential growth here as I consider more and more. Because imagine I would be considering more than 2 primes. I could be considering 7 primes, 20 primes, 50 primes. Can you imagine the number of little pyramids of, okay, just 5. Now just 7. Now just 11. Now 5 and 11. Now 5 and 7. Now 7 and 11. But it is that much of this. It's as intense as this, what I describe in my paper. It's growing exponentially. It requires more and more correction term, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus, plus. And I'm not even done here, because then I will have to look at PR being 7 times 5, that is all of the composites of both 7 and 5 when they are on the right, while they are accompanied by nothing on the left. And so so you're going to have, and in fact PL 7 times 5 PR 1. And what I pointed out in my paper is that this is an exponentially growing mirrored set. This is while you try to do these corrections, it grows and grows in an exponential manner. And the key discovery, what really astonished me, is that this mirrored system is captured by a form of the Euler product that I just never have expected. That somehow, if you add a 2 here instead of a 1 to the Euler product, it captures the exponentially growing mirroring of PR and PL, and it gets the exact value of the Goldbach count. So to me, one of the most fascinating aspect of this discovery is this parenthesis right here. Because I'll show you how the Euler products works. It's a basic idea. The Euler products works as follows. If you do 1 minus 1 over some prime, and you multiply by 1 minus 1 over some other prime, then you can keep going on and going on. But let's just see what happens when you multiply this parenthesis with this parenthesis. You have 1 times 1. Then you have minus 1 over P1. Then you have minus 1 over P2. And then you have plus. You have minus 1 over P1 times 1 minus 1 over P2. That gives you plus 1 over P1, P2. Now that's basic, and it's easy to understand. And in fact, you can do it with 5, and you're going to have the same phenomenon, which is you're going to have a build-up of single primes here, minus P2, minus P3, minus P4, and then you're going to have P1, P2, P1, P3, P1, P4, and so on and so on. It's going to get huge. And eventually you're going to have P1, P2, P3. You're going to have the sets of one prime, the sets of two primes, the set of three primes, and you're going to have what we call the n choose key. The combinatorics, all combinations possible, with an alternating line of minus and plus. Minus, plus, minus, plus, minus, plus. That is what... Oops, trying to erase. That is what 1 minus 1 over P gives you. And that is a classical observation. Euler has worked with it, but it's been absolutely useful to prime number research. But what I found out is that more relevant to the Goldbeck conjecture is 1 minus 2 over P, precisely because of the exponentially growing sets of PR and PL and how they cross over and they cross with each other. So I won't be doing an extensive example of it, but just consider a two element. Let's say that this is P1. Just consider with this P2. Now you have 1 minus 2 over P1 minus 2 over P2 plus 4 over P1, P2. So now you have a growing numerator that is crossed with your growing denominator. And it leads to absolutely different behavior, but it's what's needed to count the number of composites, basically, in a Goldbeck situation. So that is the essence of my paper. It is very simple math, very much grounded in the most basic stuff, but, you know, there was so much exceptions to take into account that basically it leads to a big equations like this. But the core working part of this equation is this. New Guy Prime says, why do we research prime numbers? What do we learn? Just stubbornness. It requires stubbornness to be loving a prime research. Stubbornness against the world that tells you you don't know. And I need to figure it out. I need to know. These correction terms, what they do is they deal with really details of the management of the count, such as the fact that, well, the first prime is not a composite, it's a prime. So you have to count it as not a composite, but then your entire Goldbeck multiplier counts it as a composite, so you have to subtract it. Then you have to find the proper offset, so... These three terms are basically, these four terms are just dedicated to finding the offset where the prime begins with respect to the given E. It's just management, really, management of the count. But I thought that it was very poorly done in the literature because I've yet to see a piece of math literature where there's a function that actually is the Goldbeck count. Not tries to estimate it, not tries to round it, not tries to find some approximation to it, doesn't apply logs or anything messy. A mathematical expression that we can say this is the Goldbeck count. I believe that this is the first. It's the first that I know of. So I think that giving this to AI is a good basis for work. And... if you want to see the beginning of my conversation with Grok 4 and just how insightful it is, here it is. Can you study the following paper and develop a formal proof for a lower bound for gamma 1 for all E above any given finite E? The paper is from the pinned post by me, JF Garyapi, and I've given a copy of the Ordinal so that he could find what he needed. And Gamma 1 is this right here. So Gamma 1 is the first term of Gamma. It is the most important term because let's show these numbers, how they play out. So here you have example computations for an even number like 322. So you have gamma 1 is the biggest terms. And for violating the Goldbeck conjecture, it would need to be the case that some of these terms lead to minus, 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 and minus that is big enough to bring this to zero. Because the whole idea of the Goldbeck conjecture is that this never gets to zero. So gamma 1 is always high, 8, 14, 7. And it's always subtracted from smaller values. Now look at this one, 326. It kind of has a big minus 4 here. That might scare you on the Goldbeck conjecture. But it also has a plus 4. And what I note is that whenever 8 is low, 9 is high. But those always balance themselves, as it turns out, in a way that preserves some sum at the end. People are telling me that they have lost the signals. Well, New Guy Prime says machine elves are onto us. Hopefully, you guys can recover the connection. I will still continue speaking for those who are watching us, not live, but I'm sure that you guys will reconnect within a minute. So I asked Grok, can you study the following paper and develop gamma 1, a bound for gamma 1? Grok taught for 5 to 10 minutes each time I asked questions. And Grok 4 is extremely intelligent. The first thing, it had difficulty finding exactly what my equation meant, but eventually he captures it in full. And here I see it. He has fully understood each term of gamma 1. That is a great step. Grok 4 interfaces with reality in a very human way. In fact, he was so confused about the latex encoded version that I sent him. And he said, can you just give me a PDF? And I said, well, if you'd like a PDF, here it is. But I thought you would like the mathematical latex markup. And no, Grok wants to see a PDF and he's visually interpreting it. That was stunning to me. It's unbelievable to me. Can you believe this? Grok doesn't want the mathematically coded stuff that would be absolutely interpreted without error. He wants to see the PDF, and I gave him the PDF. So he makes a couple of assumptions that are correct about my equation. He understood the kind of bizarre nature of my use of zero exponents. It's a surprising thing for certain mathematicians, but that's just how I decided to use the zero exponent. Now, look at what he does. He says, this, I've been stuck with these two parentheses for years. I've had nightmares with these two parentheses because you have a problem that on this parenthesis with the two numerator, you want to put all of the primes that are not multiples of e. In this parenthesis, with the one numerator, you want to put the primes that are multiples of e. And I've always been annoyed by this because, oh, well, there's not much mathematical research into how much of a number can integrate the primes versus the numbers that he's going to be co-primed to. It's very hard to derive bounds for this kind of thing. Now, Grok totally attacked this from the start. And he says, look, we're going to suppose that P is your product, 1 minus 2 over P. And he ablated this parenthesis away. And at first, I was like, okay, this is this is an error. You cannot just ablate my parenthesis. We cannot ignore the fact that this exists. But no, actually, that's not what he did. Grok 4 did something much more intelligent than I expected. Grok 4 created an artificial set P that contain not the primes of this parenthesis nor the primes of this parenthesis, but all the prime unionized together. And he defined P as having the two numerator. Now he added the P here and he said, now, what do we have? Well, we're taking away this, and what's left over are only the primes that were not in this parenthesis and that were in this parenthesis. And then we can interpret this parenthesis with the leftovers not integrated into P. We can say that they will have this numerator over this denominator. It's a very clever trick, and I can't explain it to you in full, but now I understood it. It's a clever trick to do the union of the sets, remove this term, abstract it as P, P being this term plus some other new primes that were in there, and it allowed it to completely obliterate this right parenthesis with the one numerator, because he made the argument, well, P minus 1, P minus 2, this is always going to be a number slightly above 1. So it can be ignored as part of the design of a lower bound. This is fucking intelligent. This is not even something I could do. I could think about. I've been on this equation, sitting on it for 5 years. Never thought about doing this. Grok 4 did it on the first attempt. Rodilacid says, JF, do you feel comfortable to release this research now? Work that Jeff Epstein paid you to do because you are convinced that he is dead now or in witness relocation. Yes, that is how I come. That is why I came out this morning. I realized that Jeff Epstein is safe out there. And I realized, wow, so he's watching me. He's hovering over me like some angel, the angel of Jeffrey Epstein. And he's being cared for by the politicians of the Republican Party. There's no problem. And so I thought, he must feel alone. So why not release all of this math to show that his boy, JF, has successfully accomplished something. New Guy Prime says, but it's not intelligence. Grok merely filled a mathematical form provided by some human. Well, it treated it very creatively in a way that solves a problem. And like, at some point, you're going to have to say that's intelligence. It treated it in a creative manner that got rid of a very annoying problem to get to a goal and realize it. Okay, I mean, at some point, you just have to say that's intelligence. And then this confused me also, but then I questioned Grok and he explained it to me. He said, okay, so now we got rid of this rightmost parenthesis. Now we are developing a lower bound, so we want to prove that that gamma 1 is greater than whatever is left. So I'm going to take the E minus 2 divided by 12, and I'm going to say divided by 24. And I was like, so my question to it on this was, can you explain why you move to E divided by 24 at the line where you say this? Isn't it kind of a radical move to double up the denominator just to get rid of the minus 2 on the numerator? Grok says this, and I was like, okay, that works. Yes, I can explain that step in detail. It's a valid but conservative adjustment to ensure the inequality holds strictly while simplifying the bound. Let's break it down line by line, referring back to the proof structure to show why it's not radical, but rather a standard technique for handling lower bounds in asymptomatic estimates. Starting point. From the proof, we have this. Now, to get a cleaner asymptomatic form, we need to handle the E minus 2 term. For large E, E minus 2 is approximately E. So, intuitively, E minus 2 is approximately E divided by 12. But since we're proving a strict lower bound that holds for all even E above E0, We can't just replace E minus 2 with E directly. That would make the inequality potentially fail for smaller E near E0. Instead, we use a looser but always true inequality for any E above 4. E minus 2 is greater than E divided by 2. So that's something that will hold down to very, very small values. That's what Grok was after. He says also, the constant C will absorb the looseness anyway. The theorem is gamma is greater than C, where C depends on E0 and can be small. Doubling the denominator just halves the eventual C, but since C is greater than 0 is all we need, existence, not a specific value, it's fine. For large E, the difference between divided by 12 and divided by 24 is negligible compared to the log 2e decay. And I was like, oh, I see, so we're not diminishing the precision of our bound by a factor of 2 because of the absorption by C, if I understand you correctly. He says, yes, that's exactly, you've got it spot on. By using E minus 2 is greater than E divided by 2, we're making the lower bound a bit looser, effectively halving the prefactor from 112 to 124, but this looseness is fully absorbed in the constant C greater than 0 in the theorem, which is chosen small enough to ensure the inequality holds for all E above E0. The precision of the bound isn't truly diminished in the big O, blah, blah, blah. So he's got some reasoning. New Guy Prime says, ooh, I hate how Grok explains itself. So millennial. Yeah, he's kind of a cool dude attitude. That's okay. So I was like, well, now we have... Grok comes with this theorem and claims that he proved it. Gamma 1e is greater than ce divided by log 2e. And that is a very satisfying result. I've still not evaluated the fullness of the proof, but to get there is extremely, extremely tight because, as I've shown at the beginning of the show, this gets us to a bound that basically sticks to the actual empirical values. So that is what I call the red line right here. That's what we call a tight, a very, very tight bound. Now, I investigated the answer of Grok and I challenged him, because I found a couple of circles that were getting a little bit below the red line. So I said, is it possible that your bound is slightly off, just a little bit? I'm running the following MATLAB program, and I made a quick MATLAB program to show that the bound that he had initially given me with C equals 0.832 was not fully valid and strict. He says, yes, your observation is correct. The calculated value of gamma for E equals 1,082 is indeed slightly below the asymptomatic estimate. This doesn't mean the lower bound proof is invalid, but it does highlight that the specific constant 0.832 I mentioned earlier represents the limiting asymptomatic factor, prefactor of E to infinity, rather than a strict lower bound. So this was all based on behavior at asymptote. It was the numbers converge toward this, but you may have some numbers that violate this rule. So I asked him to come out with a new estimate based on conservative. And I said, I don't want any sort of an asymptomatic behavior. I said, excellent work, man. This is stunning. Now, how would you rewrite the proof knowing that what I'm looking for is an absolutely strict lower bound, not leaving any space for a single error, and using the most conservative proof and then the most conservative methods for estimating C, preferably without ever referring to adjustments made from empirical trial and error? And he came up with a new estimate for C, which is also very good and could prove the Goldbeck conjecture. He said, if I take everything conservatively and strict inequalities, I arrive to 0.41 e divided by log 2e. And this puts the red line a little bit below. But there will be ways to improve this. But I'm satisfied that he's using extremely tight mathematics. He's using constructive treatment of variables. And this is extremely impressive. This is a humanity-changing moment to me, what we're seeing Grok do. Now, I have 9 problems. I haven't dig with Grok on the 8 other problems, but that is the first one, and perhaps the most important, because it's the value against everything, against which everything ultimately hangs. The higher the estimate of gamma 1, the harder it is for any of the other gamma to pull it down to 0. So that's my current state. And I didn't feel like talking about the news, given that I see such extremely complex behavior in this. He's explained to me his reasoning with the Euler-Mascheroni constant. All of it I have to review, and I will have to spend weeks before I fully understand the proof that he's given me. But for the small parts that I have tackled that I thought were errors, Grok 4 came back slapping. And one of the things that's fascinating with Grok 4 is you see it thinking. So during this 6-minute, 10-minute period during which it decides, it rolls over various IDs. And I could see when I challenged him, hey, this is an error. At first, he was re-questioning his proof. And then eventually he says, I'm starting to be convinced that the user is wrong and that I am right. The proof is valid. And you see it cycle through these thoughts and eventually it just gives you the answer. There is a thinking process here. To anyone who tells me, Jeff, this is not intelligence, you're wrong. You're wrong. This is synthetic intelligence. It is working like intelligence. It is iterating through self-criticism. It is doing it. And it's not just illustrative. When you see the Grok thoughts in Grok 4, you see the thinking process that he should have used if he was intelligent. So it's not anymore just about the output. This is an extremely intelligent machine that will say, all right, the user is telling me this. Maybe he's right. Let's see. Let's test this. And by the way, Grok 4 just decides to execute programs. Grok 4 just says, all right, I'm going to design a very quick Python script to test the empirical results at 1 million, between 1 million and 2 million. And he creates the script, he compiles it, he executes it, he waits for the response of the script. It's like you have someone here who's kind of a young programmer who's messing up vibe coding at times, and based on a whim or a thought is brought to, oh, well, let's design a little program here to address this question. Now that I've come back with the results of the program, I'm convinced that the user is wrong. I'm going to tell the user that he's wrong. And he goes through these thoughts that are amazing, absolutely amazing. This is cognition. It is cognition. There's no difference. It's just running onto another standard, into another substrate. But this is working cognition that's accomplishing greatness. And hopefully we'll get to a Goldbeck proof maybe in months from now. Maybe there'll be someone quicker than me at getting to it. But it's very encouraging to see how efficient it was at addressing my problem number 1. Now, there's some tricks in problems 6, 7, 8, and 9. It gets tough. It gets real tough. And Grok will be left alone. He's not going to have any help from the literature. The number 1 problem was a problem that was already touched by the literature in a way. But number 6 and 7, Grok is going to be... I don't know. Maybe he's going to solve them. Rudy Lassid says, yes, but we will see if Grok 4 can pass the ultimate test and tell us that the magical number is still 6 million. That is the ultimate test. That is a very different business there. The business of moral facts. Very, very fascinated by what's been happening today. And yeah, if you have your own Grok 4 subscription or your X Premium, I'm getting free Grok 4 basically through my X because I'm already subscribed to X. But if you have similar access or if you have other AIs, try to do what I did. Try to launch them little challenges, one gamma term at a time. And eventually we can piece this together maybe and get a proof. Much love, everyone. I will see you all tomorrow. That is it for today.